thanks for inviting me. Thank you, Cliff, for inviting me. And I'm delighted to have this opportunity to talk to this audience about work that I'm pretty excited about. That was really the first project of my graduate student Fei Ge, and done in collaboration with Francis Jan Sierra-Racine, a professor at the University of New Mexico. And I want to start off actually by drawing a comparison between the solar system and the primordial plasma. So, as we know, most natural systems are too complicated for us to calculate what should be happening from first principles. And these are two really interesting exceptions. So these are natural systems where the relevant physics is simple enough that the system is highly calculable. And they're both largely very well described by their these respective models. On the one hand, Newtonian dynamics and Newtonian universal gravitation. And then the other, our standard cosmological model, lambda CDM. And the data we have about them is very high precision data and largely in agreement with their respective models. In the case of the solar system, this is first noticed in the 19th century by Le Verrier, that the perihelion precession of Mercury is not consistent with Newton's laws and what the other planets are doing. And so that was a challenge to this universal gravitation of Newton. And although we don't have any significant problems internal to the CMB, or clear obvious problems internal to the CMB, if you take the lambda CDM model and you condition its parameters on the available data, mostly, definitely with the CMB, you get a value for the Hubble constant that's lower than our most precise, more direct observations indicate. And we know that how this turned out for the solar system, that the answer to this puzzle was found with general relativity. And we do not know how this shakes out in the case of this Hubble constant problem. This is by no means a complete summary of the observational situation with the Hubble constant, but it is what has been. It is really the main thing that's been driving a lot of theoretical work. So here, as I said, right, if you take CMB data plus assumption of the standard cosmological model, you get this lower value of the Hubble constant. And the least most precise of the efforts to determine this expansion rate more directly give a much higher value. Here, this is using Cepheids to calibrate supernovae, using the supernovae as standard candles to measure the distance redshift relation out into the Hubble flow. And these are discrepant at greater than about four sigma. So as I said, this has driven a lot of theoretical activity to try to change this lambda CDM model and try to see if the uncertainty in the Hubble constant can be increased, or maybe even the central value shifted up. And there's a recent paper summarizing how well different models are doing, playfully titled the H-Knot Olympics. This is just from this summer, so it was quite timely with the Olympics going on. And I just want to show you some of the results here. For us, it doesn't matter the details of these models. And in fact, it doesn't really matter what this parameter M sub B is when you look at that at the Hubble constant here. And so here's lambda CDM. And then here are these extensions. And you'll notice that this is reducing the tension, but also notice that it's difficult to get the Hubble constant up into this region. At least these models aren't doing it. These models aren't doing it. Here's a model that does get up into the region. This is in fact the gold medalist from the H-Not Olympics. But still, it's even with this model, this definitely greatly reduces the tension, but at the cost of two extra parameters. What one of the questions is that's driven our research is, why is it so hard to get a higher Hubble constant? Why can't theoretical models be consistent with say H naught equals 80? So here's a quick summary of what we're seeing with other models for once they're constrained by CMB data, what the probability density is for the Hubble constant. And our work in trying to understand why has led us to a model in which this can extend out to much higher values of the Hubble constant. We do have a problem in as we've implemented it now. I feel it would be dishonest to show you this plot and not own up to that problem right away, which is that we only get this posterior density by letting helium go to values the fraction of baryonic mass in helium, the amount of helium in the universe be less than not only what we would normally predict with Big Bang nucleosynthesis, but also less than what is inferred from observations of how much helium there is in the universe. So this is a significant problem we're looking for ways to solve. This problem needs to be solved, but this actually is a path towards a resolution of the Hubble constant tension.
Just a quick question. Are the contours in the Olympics plots, are they 1, 2 sigma?
Yes.
So is it 1 sigma or 2 sigma or both?
They're both. They're both, right? There's two.
Oh, okay. I see.
So the ones you're seeing are the 2 sigma.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So here's my plan for the seminar today. One of the main reasons that it's hard to change the cosmological model to be consistent with a higher Hubble constant is that you're talking about changing a model that has been extremely successful at explaining some high precision data. So first I want to tell you about successes of Lambda CDM. And then we're going to look at a series of different scaling transformations to cosmological models, and that one can use to boost the Hubble constant, and then also look at the symmetry breaking effects that prevent them from really being able to do that. And this series of scaling transformations then concludes with an exact symmetry. There's an asterisk there because this is exact in the limit of equilibrium recombination. So there's a footnote there. And this exact symmetry, we were excited to discover this, and then we were eager to find a way to implement it in an actual cosmological model. And we'll see how that naturally led us to this mirror world addition to the dark sector. And then I'll talk about the new questions that it leads us to, including our helium problem. So just as a reminder, here is a cartoon description of the thermal history of the universe. And so we have this time.
Can I ask just a quick question? It's very tempting. Hi, how are you? Do you by any chance solve the lithium problem, or that's also still there?
We did not solve the lithium problem.
Okay, you just add the helium. Okay, no problem.
We just create a helium problem.
Okay, just create it. Okay, but let's solve the Hubble. That's still good. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. Right, the universe goes through this transition of being ionized. So there's all these free electrons around that the photons readily scatter off of. The mean free path for a photon is very short. And then the universe expands and cools sufficiently that the free electrons disappear inside atoms, and this thermal light starts traveling freely. And here's a picture of our past light cone. Here we are here and now, going back out on our past light cone. We go back in time and back away from us until we hit this time when the universe underwent that transition from an opaque ionized plasma to a transparent neutral gas. And so when we image the sky at what are about millimeter to centimeter wavelengths today, we are seeing the light, you know, for the most part, we're seeing light that last interacted with the universe with matter in the universe at this time out here at this edge of the observable universe. So as you know, we've mapped the full sky. Here's a full sky map, right? This is the full sky projected onto a flat screen. This is giving us a picture of what's happening on that last scattering surface all around us. Our models don't predict these maps. Our models predict statistical properties of these maps. And the most important statistic is the power spectrum. And so if we decompose this map into its natural basis of spherical harmonics, we can ask about the amplitude variance in each of these spherical harmonics. So spherical harmonics with L equals 1,000, how much power is there? And that's what this power spectrum is telling us. And the points with error bars are measurements of the fluctuation power. And this this gray region here is actually, it's not a best fit model. It's a prediction of lambda CDM given the WMAP data. And so to make that clear, let's zoom in. This, you know, just given the WMAP data, lambda CDM makes a really precise prediction for what should be out here. And, you know, when I first looked at this, when we were, you know, thinking about, okay, what are we going to be learning from the South Pole Telescope? By measuring out here at smaller angular scales, seeing these spherical harmonic modes that fluctuate more rapidly, seeing the power in them. And this is such a tight prediction, I thought for sure that, you know, this is really exciting to me. We were going to be finding problems with lambda CDM and then getting to figure out, having the opportunity to think about what's going on. But what actually happened is the following, as I guess most of you know. So from these ground-based experiments, South Pole Telescope, Atacama Cosmology Telescope, and then from Planck, the results actually just, you know, pretty much fell right on this curve. It's just, you know, an amazing success of this standard cosmological model to have predicted this based on earlier data. Here's a image of the same power spectrum. This is now a best fit model fit to the temperature power spectrum from Planck. It looks a little different just because I've changed the, this is now a linear y-axis here, whereas before we were looking at a log. So this is a best fit to the data from the lambda CDM model, of course, the data points. And then here's the residual plot giving you some indication of the quality of this fit. So Planck, SPT, ACT have also made polarization measurements. And so here's some polarization measurements and a model that has not been fit to the polarization data here, but but just fit to the temperature data. So this is also, right, a prediction based on the temperature data for what should be seen in polarization. And there's quite a high degree of agreement. In interest of time, I'm just gonna skip the lensing power spectrum, but there's agreement there. And move into talking about scaling transformations in cosmology and symmetry breaking effects. All in, you know, trying to understand the relationship between CMB observables and the Hubble constant. So here's again this little cartoon of our past light cone in a particular model, and now I'm adding a little cartoon of our past light cone in another model, and so here's a chance for audience participation. My question is, let's see. So in both of these models, right, this transition happens at 3,000 degrees Kelvin, just about, and then today the temperature is about 3 Kelvin, so that's the case in both of these models. The temperature is going down as 1/1 the scale factor. So this 3,000 to 3 Kelvin difference happens because that scale factor, the universe has scaled up. All length scales have scaled up by a factor of 1,000. And my question is, you know, which model has a universe that's expanding more rapidly? What is it? So in your answers in the chat could be either A or B, right? Which model has the universe expanding more rapidly?
When you think, I don't really understand what's the difference between the two models. Sorry.
This one, the distance from here and now to last scattering is smaller in this model.
Oh, I see. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So, which one is expanding more rapidly? Are people using the chat and I just don't see it? Or, oh, okay, here come some things. Okay. Okay, great. Glad I asked. So the thing about the more rapid expansion is that then it takes less time for the universe to expand by a factor of 1,000, or more like 1,100 actually. And if it takes less time for the universe to expand by a factor of 1,100, the light that was released at this time, it's going to take less time to get to us, right? So this last scattering surface ends up being closer. So you're expanding more rapidly. There's less time since the universe was 3,000 Kelvin, and so light travels less of a distance to get to us from that time. So this is so model A is the correct answer. And I'm sorry, we're going to have to take back Jen Pan's PhD. just kidding, Jen.
If that were a thing, how many of us would have PhDs left?
right. Yeah. You were in good company there with Cliff, Jen. Okay. And I should say that when Jen was a student here, and occasionally he'd come into my office with a question about something, my immediate reaction would be, oh my God, Jen Pan doesn't understand this. How am I going to be able to help? Okay, back to the seminar. So So model A has the fast expansion, model B the slow expansion. And you know, the one question is, how do we tell which universe we're in, right? This fast expansion one or the slow expansion one? And at least in the Lambda CDM model, we're given this length scale, which turns out to be about 147 megaparsecs. This is how far a sound wave or any disturbance in the plasma can propagate from the beginning until the plasma disappears, right, at this temperature of around 3000 Kelvin. So we can, if we can measure what that sound horizon subtends from here, measure this angle, then that should tell us about the size of the universe and whether we're in a slow expansion universe or a fast expansion universe, size of the observable universe, I should say. And so observationally, that sound horizon turns out to be connected with the radius of a typical hot spot or cold spot in a CMB map. And measurements from the Planck satellite put that at very close to 0.6 degrees. And so at least with this assumption of lambda CDM, it looks like, in this measurement, it looks like we live in the slow expansion case, more like 67 kilometers per second megaparsec than 73 kilometers per second per megaparsec. Now, what if we, what if, which is actually is the case, somebody actually measured the expansion rate though and said, hey, it's actually 73. How can we reconcile this fact? Well, if we scaled up the expansion rate at all values of the scale factor A by some constant F, if we scaled that up everywhere, then we could increase the expansion rate at all times and certainly today and not change the size of this angle. So this sound horizon, that distance also depends on how rapidly the universe expands from infinite temperature down to 3000 Kelvin. And with the faster expansion rate, that's going to be less time. And so a disturbance in the plasma is going to travel less of a distance. And these two distances scale in the same way, the sound horizon and the distance to last scattering from here. And so this angular size of the sound horizon is preserved under this transformation. So we can then have this, this degeneracy, as far as observations go, between these two models, the slow model, where we've got the last scattering surface far away, but with a big sound horizon, or we have it nearby, but with a small sound horizon. So how do we change the model to do that? Here are all of the significant components in the standard cosmological model, neutrinos, photons, dark matter and atoms, and then dark energy, and how they're, as the scale factor increases, as the universe is expanding, how the energy density is dropping with that expansion. And so if we scale up each one of these components, and also, right, because of the Friedman equation that relates expansion rate to density, if we scale up each one of these, we can realize this transformation, H of A goes to F times H of A. We can do that when we're certainly free to adjust in our model the value of the cosmological constant. We can adjust the dark matter density today, and so that can increase this non-relativistic matter contribution to the energy density, and then we can introduce extra light particles, new light relics, to boost the radiation density. We can't increase the photon density because we know the density of photons today from the FIRAS measurement. But we can add, there's nothing to prevent us from adding new relic massless species to increase the radiation density. So we can do that. And interestingly, right, it leads us to considering additional light relics, which is something that naturally comes out of people trying to solve other problems in particle physics. But there's a this transformation, there's not an exact symmetry to this transformation. Yes, you can preserve the angular size of the sound horizon, but there's other things that we're observing than just the angular size of the sound horizon. And in particular, there's this diffusion length, which does not scale appropriately under this transformation. So the diffusion, so this diffusion is that, right, as the mean free path becomes larger, right, as the number density of free electrons drops, the mean free path of a photon becomes larger, and it does some diffusing before last scattering toward us. And the larger that diffusion length is, the more suppression there is of small scale anisotropies, right? If you've got a hot spot here and a cold spot here, and photons are diffuse out of the hot spot all the way over here before scattering to us, then that suppresses the anisotropy that we see. And since this is a random walk process, it won't be surprising for you to hear that it's the square of the distance that goes up with the time there is to diffuse. And so it's not too surprising to see that it's the square of the diffusion length that goes like 1 power of 1/h. And the problem then is that, right, then this distance is going like, this diffusion distance is going like 1/√h, or 1/√f, or our scaling factor f. But the distance to last scattering is going like 1/f. And so the angle changes. The diffusion angle is not invariant then under this h of a goes to f h of a. And you can see that here in the simulated map where we go from nf equals 1 to nf equals 10. Scaling up the expansion rate everywhere. No, it's not just the number of light species that's being increased here, but also the amount of cosmological constant, the amount of dark matter in order to preserve the angular size of the sound horizon, right? We're following the scaling prescription. And you can see the diffusion length changing, right? So the angular scale of the diffusion length is bigger here when we're looking at the small sound horizon nearby situation. So that breaks the symmetry, and it takes us to there's a straightforward fix to this, which we'll call scaling transformation number two, which is to add in a scaling of this scattering rate, photon electron scattering rate, sigma t n e. So if we also scale that by f, then rd squared goes like 1/f², and then theta d is independent of f, and we no longer have that symmetry breaking effect. And this brings us to helium, right? Which is gonna end up being a problem for us. But in principle, one can use helium to implement this scaling. And here's just a little cartoon explaining that with a, here I've cataloged the contents of a very tiny universe that just has three hydrogen atoms in it, two helium atoms in it, right? These things are protons, these things are neutrons, this is an electron. So here's three protons and three electrons. So this is the content of this universe, at least at this one point in time where, the ratio of free electrons to hydrogen atoms is 0.5. And the helium is completely neutral. And that's the case in the real universe, according to our models, right? And based on atomic physics, that when hydrogen is just half ionized, helium is completely neutral because it's higher binding energy. So what happens though if we reduce the amount of helium at fixed baryons? So let's take one of these helium nuclei apart and preserve this ratio of Ne over NH equals 0.5. And the result is we have two more free electrons. And in general, the free electron density is proportional to 1 minus yp, where yp is the fraction of baryonic mass in helium. Anyway, the thing qualitatively to take away here is decreasing the amount of helium boosts the number of free electrons, so it's going to scale up that rate. And we can realize the scaling transformation by not only doing these things with the matter content, which will do this part, but also by scaling down the amount of helium, or increasing 1 minus yp, because that'll increase the number density of free electrons.
So can I just ask, why is it just helium in specific? Why don't you do the same to other elements?
Oh, because basically the only thing we have in the universe is hydrogen and helium, right? These are the only things that come out of the Big Bang produced in any significant amount. So basically we're starting from a model that only, you know, that only has hydrogen and helium.
I see. All
right. And for good, and for good reason.
Yeah,
thanks.
Can I follow up on that question? So it seems to me you want to do this with the electron density, but you could have done it with the, Thomson cross-section as well. Is that
absolutely?
Okay. So are you going to talk about that then?
Well, I don't have any, we can talk about that some later. Sure. I don't have much to say about it. Except that for a little while, Cliff and I were both excited that maybe we'd be able to do the scaling with something that he's been working on that would allow for the Thomson cross section to vary. But then we both realized that it doesn't look like it'll work, at least in that case. We haven't figured it out yet.
Cool. Thanks.
Yeah.
Just to follow that up, is it true so far as your story goes now that if your goal was to change sigma Tn by this factor F, and you did do it by scaling the Thomson cross section, then you would not need to change the 1 minus yp in the bottom, right?
Absolutely correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And just while we're on it, right? At least what Cliff and I had thought about so far, the problem with it was that it scaled, you could scale sigma T, but you'd also be scaling the binding energy of hydrogen. And and so that would also, of course, have its effect on the number density of electrons. Which would be more dramatic and I think cause problems. It still might work, but it's just not guaranteed to work by a scaling symmetry.
Okay, cool, thanks.
Yeah. So let's see how that works. Right, NF is this parameter that's controlling this addition of light and dark new species. And it's defined so that in the case of the standard model where we've got three species of neutrinos, it comes out to three, or for technical reasons, 3.046. So NF is just, think of this as controlling this density in dark and light species. So what happens if we free up the amount of helium? So I should say this is lambda CDM extended to allow this NF to be a free parameter, and then constrained by Planck CMB measurements. And now if you free up helium, well, you get to widen this up some, because you have a way of now of keeping the diffusion scale as it should be, as observed. But it still doesn't open it up so much. So why is that? And it turns out that there are other symmetry breaking effects at play that there's a difference that arises if you have free streaming light relics as opposed to fluid light relics. So like the plasma is, at least prior to recombination. So if you can freely stream at the speed of light out of overdensities, that has a significant effect on how gravitational potentials evolve. And that leads to observable consequences. So there's this difference between free streaming species and fluid species, where you've got disturbances in the fluid propagating more slowly with a sound speed of square root of 1/3, as opposed to speed of light. And so this was I think first pointed out by Baczynski and Seljak. There's an effect on the temporal phase of the acoustic oscillations that we first pulled out of the data. This is Jen Pan here, played an important role in actually enabling this analysis to detect for the first time this subtle effect of this supersonic propagation of the neutrinos in the primordial plasma. And Bauman et al. Were nearly simultaneous with us in detecting that as well. So this plays a role in constraining light relics, even in the presence of this helium freedom. So we can ask, well, what if we allow some fraction of the additional light relics to be a fluid? Well, that opens things up further. But it's still, it's still constrained. And this was basically the starting point for the work of with Feige and Francis Yan, was us puzzling over why when we've added this degree of freedom, do we still have this light relics constrained? And yes, this opens it up some, but why not more? What's going on? And after a year and a half of banging our heads against the wall and me worrying that Faye was going to quit cosmology, we actually managed to figure things out, and we realized that if we realized that there was this exact symmetry in the equations of evolution, the Boltzmann and Einstein equations, that and this is essentially I'm getting a little ahead of my story here. This is scaling transformation number 3. It leads to scaling transformation number 2, but it's more specific, right? So certainly because of the Friedmann equation, if you're scaling up all your components, so I is running over your different components, photons, neutrinos, dark matter, baryons. If you're scaling up all of them, then definitely you'll get H of A goes to F H of A, but it's also more specific. And before I get to why it works, let me just tell you the sense in which it does work. So if we do this scaling, where this is the amplitude of the primordial power spectrum, then dimensionless cosmological observables are exactly invariant. This includes CMB temperature and polarization, galaxy clustering, baryon acoustic oscillations, weak lensing. It leaves density ratios, omega matter, omega lambda, et cetera, matter radiation equality, matter fluctuation amplitude, so this sigma 8 and S8, the baryon to photon ratio are exactly invariant under this transformation. And I should point out that Zahn and Zaldarriaga 18 years ago had almost proposed this scaling. They proposed it without this part. And this part has, not including this part has severe consequences on what you observe. Putting this in, really works. So here's if we just implement that scaling directly, here are the CMB power spectra, temperature polarization, temperature cross polarization for three models, three different values of this F scaling things up, and nothing has changed across these model spectra. So H0 is 67.5, 74.3, 81. is what we have in these three models. This is the value of F, 1.0, 1.1, 1.2.
Lloyd, can I ask, are you also changing tau when you're changing AS or no?
We're not changing tau. So well, actually, we probably are changing tau a little bit. That's a good question.
I think you shouldn't change it because the dimensionless quantities you shouldn't change. It's only dimensionful quantities that you're changing.
Yeah. I mean, tau must be fixed, but to really get this, here we're fixing the ionization fraction, and so it's just occurring to me that. If we're fixing the ionization fraction and changing, I think it leaves, no, sorry. This must leave tau invariant, actually, this transformation. So tau is fixed under this transformation. Tau doesn't change. We're artificially keeping the ionization fraction fixed here. Although the number density of scatterers goes up, that integrated optical depth will be the same. So why does this work? If you look at, what are all the dimensional constants in the equations of motion? Right, so you write the equations of motion as derivatives with respect to scale factor. And you take what are all the dimensional coefficients that show up? It's just these two. This inverse of the gravitational time scale and this photon scattering rate. And then if you look for dimensional constants in the initial conditions, there aren't any, right? We're assuming a power law for the initial conditions, which is what we expect out of inflation. Here's an example of Boltzmann equation. So written as here this is the dipole of the photon distribution, or you can think of it as the average velocity of the photons. And it's equation of motion here. And if this gets scaled up by F and H gets scaled up by F, and we also scale k by f, so we have k go to f times k, then that f drops out of this equation. And so the solutions to these equations won't depend on f. We can also look at the Einstein equations, right? So g rho I is going up as f squared, h squared is going up like f squared, so f drops out of this. And likewise, or we got a g rho I here, so we got f squared on this. All of these terms, right, end up with an f squared, so it just drops out, and so the solutions don't depend on f. Here we've got a pi times g, but if pi is proportional to the density, and if we have an equation of state p equals w rho, then this will come with a factor of f squared also. And we'll see that the symmetry exists. Let me say something about that k goes to fk, right? So that's part of the transformation. If we're thinking about a single Fourier mode, that's part of the transformation. And now when we think about the Fourier modes all together, we just need to also send the power from AS to AS over F to the NS minus one. So that corrects for the change in power amplitude that happens as you go from K to F times K.
So, Lloyd, can I ask a quick question? The same is true for lensing. So when I have like quadratic things, this holds for lensing as well?
Yeah. So certainly, if you have things that are you've basically calculated things to first order, and you're working out, you know, second order effects from the combination of those. Then that applies there as well. I still haven't taken the time to really think through the full nonlinear case, and I suspect that the symmetry is broken in the full nonlinear theory, but in perturbation theory, this is definitely a symmetry at first order in perturbation theory, definitely is for lensing to second order, and I think it's maybe good at all orders in perturbation theory, but probably not for the fully nonlinear theory.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Sorry, and one question: what about the BBN? I can believe that in all these equations, that scaling does nothing. But doesn't anything BBN depend on alpha or mass of the electron or something like?
Yeah. So right now, I'm ignoring both BBN and recombination, and let me get to those.
Okay.
Yeah. So. There's a number of ways what we've done isn't physical, so far here. And first and foremost is that we've actually scaled up the photon density in doing this, right? And that's a big problem, right? When that transformation was, we're scaling up the density of everything by some factor of F squared. And we know the density of photons today, so we can't do that. So the other thing is recombination is not an equilibrium process. So we're sensitive to rates, you know, atomic physics rates that govern the reactions between photons, electrons, and protons. And then, you know, this is the same thing for Big Bang nuclear synthesis. The Big Bang nuclear synthesis is out of equilibrium, so we're sensitive to the nuclear reaction rates. And then finally, neutrino masses, although this can be trivially solved by extending our transformation to also scale up neutrino masses. So can we actually tackle all these problems? So the Coe-Firas constraint, we can mimic this transformation by, instead of adding more photons, just add dark photons that do everything that the light photons do except talk to Firas. And then these dark photons, they need the same history as the light photons. And so we need to add in dark baryons that will interact with these dark photons so that they will transition from a fluid to free streaming, just as the light photons do. Because of how that will influence gravitational potentials, that difference between fluid and free streaming. And to scale up the neutrino density, we need to add some dark neutrinos, if you like. And so we're naturally led into all these things. And this is basically a mirror sector, which has been studied a lot for other reasons. Here's a list of papers that Francis Young compiled for us.
I ask a silly question here. This is the thing that always confuses me. So so you certainly would change the temperature with the scaling, but then there's a sense in which changing the temperature is just changing what we mean by now, right? How long it's been since the CMB. So what exactly is the observable that is you're going to get wrong if you from Coe-Firas?
Well, I mean, it's more like you just can't, you know, if you're it makes sense, right? It makes sense for any cosmological model, right? It's predicting things as some function of time or scale factor, and you have to answer the question of, well, where is today in my model, right? And we don't have clocks telling us, you know, the time. Well, we do to some degree, actually, from ways of measuring the age from stars. But a really good clock is Firas, right? So you can basically take as the definition of today when is the temperature of the CMB 2.726 Kelvin in my model? Well, that's what I mean by today. You know, so what I mean by H naught, I mean the expansion rate when the temperature of the CMB is 2.726 Kelvin. And if you look at it that way, then kind of by definition, you can't scale up the photon density at this point in our cosmological evolution, right? You can't scale up the photon density today because it's by definition, it is. Now, if you wanted to, I'd say, okay, now you have a new model, and all you've done is you've made today a different point in your model, and so you actually haven't implemented the scaling.
I guess that's the thing that confuses me, and I can ask you about it later on, because I was thinking along the lines of, if you did scale the electron mass, so you did change the binding energy of hydrogen, that would change when recombination happens,
right?
But in a way which I don't quite see why I would be getting the temperature wrong in Kobe Firas if I did all that scaling. So why is doing nothing violating the scaling that you're doing? Or I guess maybe this is what you're saying, is you're saying that I'm scaling these things at all times, and in particular, I'm scaling them now. And you're saying that so you have a handle directly on the number of photons now.
Right. Right. Yes.
Okay, let me think about that. Thank you.
Okay. This adjustment of these densities doesn't solve our helium scattering, or it doesn't solve our electron scattering rate transformation. We need to implement that in a different way, right? Because we haven't scaled up the number density of electrons, because instead of scaling up atoms, we added in dark atoms. But we can do it the same way we did it before, right? But by just scaling down the amount of helium, or scaling up 1 minus YP. So here's a, if you like, a test of our code. So we know analytically that this scaling should work. And here we're taking the Landon CDM model plus this one parameter extension, the value of F that's scaling us away from Lambda CDM. We're fixing the ionization history here. And we put a prior on the value of F. We're just not letting F go above a certain value, just to not strain some accuracy settings in the code or whatever. And so indeed we see basically the probability as we dial up F from 1 to 1.3 or whatever, however high it was we took it, the probability for the Hubble constant is about flat. That's with a fixed recombination history. So we expect this result. What we didn't know what would happen is when we actually self-consistently calculate the ionization history, right, that has these atomic reaction rates in it that we're not scaling, what happens? And it turns out that the symmetry breaking effects from these rates that we're not scaling are relatively mild, right? So we get this green curve instead. So we're still able to have high probability even for very high values of the Hubble constant. And so as a reminder, right here's where we were when we started asking this question of why are these constraints so tight? And this is what this mirror world plus low helium, free helium model gets us in terms of freeing things up. And so we can understand, I won't go through the details here because of lack of time, but we can understand now constraints on light relics as arising from the differences in these two models. So we have this mirror world dark sector where we've implemented the symmetry. How is that different from from what's happening in these models? And that helps us to understand the origin of these constraints, it also excitingly opens up a possibility that maybe the Hubble constant problem has something to do with our model. However, like I said, we have this with this low value of helium. Let's see, 55 minutes into our talking together here, this is a bit of a complicated plot to show you. Let's just look at the green contours. This is the green contours, green open contours are the constraints from Planck and BAO measurements when we're enforcing scaling. And you can see that in that case, if we want to be consistent with Riesedahl 2021, then about 2 to 3% of the dark matter is this atomic dark matter. So that's a prediction that 2 to 3% of the atomic of the dark matter should be this atomic dark matter from this mirror sector, and the temperature of the dark photons is about 0.7 of the photon temperature, or about what we get for the neutrino background. And then in this panel, you can see our problem, that this is helium abundance. And so here we are, right, scaling down from low Hubble constant, scaling from low Hubble constant to high Hubble constant. You know, here we are consistent with R21, and we're now off from Aver et al. 2021, which is a measurement, an inference of the amount of helium in the universe from looking at emission from low metallicity, hot regions of gas. That's a big part of our helium problem. The other is, which has been raised as Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And standard Big Bang nucleosynthesis goes the opposite direction for us, right? We've added new matter content. The universe will be expanding more rapidly through BBN. The amount of helium should actually increase as a result. We want a lower value of helium. So we have kind of two helium problems, one with measurement and one with BBN theory, which we could discuss more if you want. Let me move on to my conclusions now. So we've identified this previously unnoticed symmetry of dimensionless cosmological observables. We found a model that could exploit this symmetry to pretty much completely eliminate the Hubble tension. There may be other applications for this symmetry I think there are, and that will be evident with some more thought. But our work certainly led to some new questions. One of which is that I feel is most pressing for us, which is how can we achieve a higher photon scattering rate and have consistency with BBN and helium measurements. This more exciting question, can we detect the 3% of atomic dark matter in some way? And then there's a question of, can a consistent particle physics model be built of this mirror sector? And there's already a couple papers on this that I actually haven't managed to fully digest, but they're claiming that they've been able to do so. So let me stop there. I'll just put up this slide also of my broader collaborators and support, who I'm thankful for all of them. Thank you for your attention. All right, I'm done with the except for Q&A.
All right, thanks again. Here's some virtual applause. If people have questions, please feel free to unmute.
Hey Lloyd, in your mirror world, you have a copy of photons and the baryons, do you also need a copy of dark hydrogen and dark helium?
So we definitely need something like dark hydrogen. We don't appear to need any dark helium. We could tolerate it, right? So the dark hydrogen is very important, right? We need to have this atomic dark matter going through this transition of being ionized, so you have a dark electron scattering the dark photons to then being neutral, right? So we need dark protons, dark electrons that form dark hydrogen.
Okay, so if you have some dark helium, so is it possible to reduce the helium, the real helium?
The observation we need to understand is that when people observe these regions where there's hydrogen and helium and it's hot, so there's a line emission. There's the ratio of the flux of helium lines to the ratio of the flux from hydrogen lines, and somehow, right, even though we have less helium, we would need to get the high helium flux that's seen there. I'm not sure how the dark helium would help us do that, right?
Okay.
But maybe I'm mm-hmm. missing something.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So Lloyd, I think I finally get it. So can I play back to you what I think your explanation is as to why virus is a problem? Is it, so if I scale everything, I scale the temperature, and then my reaction was, well, that just means I wait longer until now, and that's when I see the temperature that I've measured. But if I waited longer, then what's going to happen is that the Hubble scale will also have gone down in that time, and so I will have failed to get the Hubble scale right. Is that
exactly?
Got it. All right, I got it. Finally.
I should have said that part. Yeah.
No, I think you did. I think it just it finally sunk in. Thanks.
So look, very interesting. I mean, I've been thinking through this, and I wonder whether you play this idea of maybe a conformally coupled scalar field. Because it seems that what all you want to do is you change all the length of scale that matter sees. If all the length of scales are rescaled by some factor, then you achieve your goal. And I wonder whether if you just have a scalar field which conformally rescales the matter, the metric that matter sees, that would achieve this goal.
What about the photons? So
this is kind of along the lines of the thing that the model I was trying to propose, where every mass in the problem scales by from power of a field, and mm-hmm. and as far as I can see, the thing it gets wrong is that it his scaling is a scaling which is proportional to the raw dimensions of everything, only if you scale Newton's constant as well, because he's scaling rho by F squared, and so it's kind of g rho, which is the thing that the square root of g rho is the thing that scales it with f. But if you had scaled the length in the Planck length as well, you would not have had the symmetry that he had. And so when we took this theory where you had a dilaton essentially coupled to mass, the thing it got wrong, it scales everything, but it doesn't scale the Planck mass in the Einstein frame. And so it was in the end of the day not implementing the scaling that he wanted at the, because the hope was that it would give you a time dependent scaling where you don't scale it now, but you do scale it then. And that seemed to be the obstruction as far as I could see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was thinking of combining this, this mass scaling with the mirror world. It's if you're trying to use Cliff's idea for just the photon scattering rate, you're also you're changing the Thomson cross section, but also unfortunately the binding energy of the electron. So you're changing when recombination happens.
I don't quite follow this. The Planck mass itself is not really important, is it? I mean, it's the proton mass and electron mass, and
his Hubble scale, in order to get H to scale, he had to have G rho scale, not just rho. Right. And so he was imagining that G was fixed as, that's confused me a little bit when he presented it, is that it looked like G was fixed as rho scaled.
Mm-hmm. But that's right. That's how we have implemented it. We've assumed G is fixed. Now one can, if one can scale G, that's another way to implement it.
You could certainly scale G, but then you wouldn't get your Thomson factor scaling, right?
But we can't scale G today, right? I mean, we're measuring G, right? So we'd have some problems, right? If we still have the expansion rate today squared given by 8 pi G rho over 3, right? And that G is connected to a Cavendish experiment or some version of that. That's a problem, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, but in this picture of a field, the field would be evolving, and so the thing is that you do all your measurements now, and you got nothing to compare to. But it's what's happening is there's a scaling at later at past epochs compared to what it is now. So there are constraints on that too, like nucleosynthesis gives you some constraints, and but they were pretty, if you're allowed to design the dynamics, right. You go a long way. But I couldn't see how to do was to just get your symmetry at recombination.
Uh-huh.
And the obstruction, and it might just be that I came in with a model in mind as opposed to just trying to build one that was going to do what you wanted. And the obstruction for me was that if I just did a scaling of all masses at that time with the Planck mass fixed, it wasn't doing what you wanted in your right. Three variables.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So it looks like Subhadip wanted to ask something. So since we have been.
All right. Hey.
Go ahead. Yeah. Hi, Subhadip.
Hey, how are you? So I have a very naive question for you. So because I was trying to understand what will happen to lines. So if you're changing sigma t by this scaling by this F factor, your fine structure constant is changing, or you're at least scaling it.
Well, it depends on how you're doing it. That's one way to do it would be changing the fine structure constant. Another way would be changing the electron mass, right? Or some combination of the two.
Right, right, right. But what I'm basically trying to ask is how the shape of the atoms will change or how the line emissions will change. Will I see a difference in the spectrum of a particular line in my lab frame?
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. And so, and there's tight constraints on from observations like that, right? So from quasars, right? Absorption line systems. And so this would have to be time dependent, and the amount of change that we need at this CMB would need to be ramped way down by the time you get to Z equals 7 or so.
I see. So one can then predict that how should the recombination line, so that this in CMB spectral distortion, you can expect lines. So one can predict, given your this theory, how that line should be observed with this F presence of this F.
Yeah, no, I think spectral distortions would be a great way to probe this.
Because your line positions of hydrogen and helium are going to change because of the scaling.
That's right.
And you can compare with the lab, whatever you know. Nice, thank you. Good to see you.
So Lloyd, since you're here, if you were here in person, I would introduce other people around. And so I see that Robin Wen is here. So he's an undergraduate at Waterloo. I don't know who he wants. So actually, we are trying to reproduce the results with Douglas Scott. So I guess he just I see his picture now. So
hi, Robin.
Hi.
Yeah, we've been corresponding with Francis about this as well.
Oh, great.
So we still, and we had some other ideas, but none of them actually work. So I think yours seems to be the best so far, but I still trying to understand that.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's impressive. Like, the symmetry does work. Like, I try, it's actually exactly the same. Okay, it's like, yeah, it's pretty, pretty impressive to do that.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So, but going back to this question of, I mean, conformal coupling, it's, I feel there is a, what you're doing is like too complicated because you want to change everything and you want everything to cancel, but I mean, it's really hard. But it seems that maybe we do it at late times instead of early times. Would that be, because then everything at early times stay the same. Basically, all we want to change is the Hubble constant now.
Right.
But, right. So everything else, if you want to keep them the same, just the Hubble constant. And so if you have this conformal field, just turns on at late times. And when, I don't know, I mean, whenever it turns down, something bad might happen. We have to kind of keep track of that. But wouldn't that work? Yeah.
Wasn't that, I think Lloyd actually shot this down for me once in that triangle for the angles, that if you're changing like the length of this, like the sound horizon, and not changing the lengths during the whole history, you know, the, between here and there, you're going to change the shape of that triangle, right?
Yeah. So you've got the sound horizon is now stayed the same, right? The arsabas, in what you're proposing, Nyesh, because only changes happen late, but you can use that sound horizon to calibrate the BAO distances, right? Mm-hmm. And so now you've got distance, and you can then use the BAO to calibrate the supernovae.
Yeah,
and now you can now you have a discrepancy at the supernova calibration level, right? Because the Cepheid calibration of supernovae says one thing, the sound horizon calibration of the supernovae says another thing, and how do you reconcile that? You know, I don't think you do. When you're thinking about late time solutions, it's really helpful to think about supernova calibration rather than H naught.
But you see, I think the thing is that all of the observations, the supernova, CMB, quasars, I guess we should talk about that. But supernova and CMB, they are dimensionless, right? So you are talking about none of them, we measure things that have units. So the only things that we measure that have units is the Hubble constant. And I guess CMB temperature.
But I thought you were talking about not changing anything at early times.
Well, but right, but those are unitless things that we're measuring. So yes, I'm saying not changing things at early times, but I'm saying that somehow. Go.
But we do have this prediction, right, in Lambda CDM that the sound horizon is 147 megaparsecs. So you'd have to get around that. Because that does then give you a way of calibrating the BAO and then the supernovae. And
No. I mean, obviously something is changing, right? But I guess what I'm saying is that the only thing that has units in our measurements and doesn't fit is the Hubble constant, right? Everything else is unitless. Am I right?
Well, FIRES, FIRES has units.
Yeah. Okay. So sorry. That's right. The CMB temperature and So I guess at some level, the two things that have units that are inconsistent are FIRES So FIRES and the Hubble constant. So I'm saying that if actually this thing and they're both late time observations because we're doing now. So if there is this coupling, this conformal coupling that I guess some basic doesn't couple to photons, but couples to matter that turns on at late time, that could I don't know if that makes sense. That could explain this description. Okay, go ahead.
I think that might work, right? Because like based on like the previous work, also what we did on TNOL was like, you know, there was a degeneracy between HNOL and TNOL, right? It's very degenerate. So I mean, of course you need to assume you don't change recombination physics. I mean, in order to say, okay, like the, you know, recombination happens, you can't change recombination history. But I think if you introduce something in late time, actually, you do kind of exploit this TNOL HNOL degeneracy, right? To basically push the thing is, if you want to go to high HNOL, then actually TNOL goes very high. But I think if you change late time expansion, you'll add some other things. Yes, I think you can do that. I think so. Yeah. I think you can.
Idea is that if you introduce some sort of new physics at late time that breaks H0, T0 degeneracy, and I don't know what that means, but photons don't couple to conformal factor, but matter do. So I can imagine if there's some field that only conformally couples to matter and turns on at late times, that could basically don't affect temperature, but affects the expansion. That affect H0 measurements, not necessarily the expansion, because that's all we need. Just all we need is we change the units of our clocks. Anyway, so I'm just thinking out loud, but just saying obviously your talk was very, very provocative and inspiring. So this is what happened. That's great, all your fault. You. Thanks.
Very nice talk. So, but let me ask you also about there were some earlier people who experimented with just changing the electron mass as a way to approach this problem, right?
Yeah.
And so, why didn't they have a problem with FIRES?
Why didn't they have a problem with FIRES? I mean, they didn't change the photon temperature.
Why didn't they? Because if they change the electron mass, it seems like on all these comparisons of scales, you know, our ruler is always coming from atomic physics, where it's basically electron mass. So it's if you change the electron mass, it seems like a lot of things are going to have to come out right, because you know all your lines are coming out at a scale set by the electron mass. So if
we haven't observed any spectral lines from recombination.
I shouldn't have mentioned line, but I was just thinking that. But what does it mean for the temperature to be what it is? It's a fixed fraction of the binding energy of a hydrogen atom.
Well, which is now, I mean, you know, really, FIRES. You know, let's go back to think about FIRES as what you know defines what today is, right? And so what change when you change the electron mass? You change the ratio of the scale factor at recombination to the scale factor today. That changes.
Okay, you're changing electron mass at all times, right?
Well, sure. Let's change it at all times.
Okay.
Then the ratio of the scale factor at recombination to the scale factor today, or you know, scale factor at temperature at 2.726 Kelvin changes, right? Certainly, the temperature at recombination will change.
Mm-hmm. But it'll be a fixed fraction of the, it's going to be still set by the binding energy, it's controlled by the binding energy of hydrogen, right?
Right.
Which is the thing that's scaled.
That's right. So that's why the temperature at which recombination happens will change.
Yeah. So before you explain why, just what's the state, when these people did their variation of the electron mass, did they have a problem with FIRES or not?
No.
And so why didn't they? That's, I guess, the question.
Because they always took today to mean when the temperature is 2.726 Kelvin.
So does that mean that if we can hand you a particle physics model that essentially scales electron mass by a factor, then we're done?
Well, then you get a solution that works as well as theirs did, and which is pretty good. I mean, I'd say that's good enough.
And is it important that it's scaled? So now, if supposing we scale the electron mass in a time-dependent way, is that going to work equally well? If I change it during recombination and not now.
I think as long as it's if you start ramping it down back to its laboratory value by z equals a few hundred, you should be fine.
Because then you're not getting the triangle wrong. You're saying that you're just changing it at one end by such a little bit, little amount.
You have very little photon scattering after then.
Because that should be doable then. Because that's the.
Yeah, sorry. I guess I got a little focused on my particular solution, but yes, if there are a reasonable way to it might work. It might work really well. The you also have this significant amount of energy in your dilaton field, right? And so that's another thing to.
Well, significant. It was not dominating or anything. It's just some fraction of what's there. So it's. I don't know what the fluctuation story is, but I think at the central value of the, you know, the means for the mean evolution, I didn't see there being a problem there.
So, but I think that, I still think it's not protected by the scaling symmetry, but, you know, clearly this model had phenomenological success.
So yeah. I had thought that model was kind of living off of your scaling symmetry, but it sounds like you're saying it's not, that if you just scale electron mass, that's not your scaling symmetry.
No. Yeah.
Do you also have to do you have to also avoid changing the mass of the electron, you know, near BBN, right? Because you're dumping that much.
I can do. That's the beauty of this model is that the scalar field that's controlling the masses satisfies some field equation, and you can arrange for it to be basically the same at BBN as it is now, and what happens is it likes to do dramatic things right around matter radiation recombination because it kicks it out of a tracker solution into a different tracker solution, and that's just right at the right time to get the recombination to see something bigger than anybody else does.
Okay, great.
Yeah, it's a bit of a just so story, but it's I had thought that it was because it wasn't reproducing your scaling symmetries and it was basically hopeless. But if it's true that just changing the masses is good enough,
they do better when they're also letting curvature be free. Why not?
I guess one thing is quasar spectra, aren't you going to screw those up if you change the electron mass?
Well, in Cliff's model, it has to be, the electron mass has to come back. What is it, Z equals 7 or Z equals 4? Or
a few hundred, I guess you were saying, right?
Right.
Oh, no, I was saying that you want to maintain it to a few hundred at its changed value, so the transition should be somewhere between z equals 300 and z equals 7. If the transition were there, then I think you're fine.
Mm-hmm. All right, a challenge. Well, that's interesting. Okay, so I'm encouraged.
Good.
And really, if the program was to change every mass in the problem except for the Planck mass, that doesn't screw. It's really all you really are sensitive to is electron mass.
That's right. Hmm. Yeah, except for BBN, as was pointed out. But that's okay.
Right, but if you would bring it all back. Bring it all back home by then. That's interesting. All right, that's good to know.
Yeah, I hadn't really landed home for me either. So I guess it's a lesson to myself not to get so obsessed with my own model.
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to ask this directly then. If your paper was included in the Olympics, are you saying you would steal the gold medal?
If you had
a model for this.
Yeah, it depends on their attitude toward the helium problem. So
I see.
I think it would be fair to say I don't know. It depends on their attitude toward that. I mean, you know, these guys are varying the electron mass. They don't know how are they getting away with that? Yeah, anyway, so I mean, they have a problem too, right? So I shouldn't be too quick to disqualify myself.
Yeah.
So, but I don't know whether we'd win or not for that reason.
Yeah. You'll have to play for the California Olympic Committee rather than for the US.
Lloyd, for your helium problem, if we had some way to measure like the electron density today, would that then kill this model? I mean, you know, if it matches what we expect.
The electron density today?
Yeah, right. I mean, like, so, your model, if I understood.
No, I don't think so. I mean, because there's so little, you know, there's almost no photon scattering happening today. So we don't.
Not for tau. I mean, like in your model, you were just rescaling all the densities of everything, right?
Well, in order to get around FIRAS, we don't scale the photon density. And then because of the sensitivity, this is a point I didn't emphasize and didn't even make really. There's another reason we're not scaling the baryons, right? Just like we're not scaling the photons, we're not scaling the baryons. We're putting in dark baryons. So the baryon to photon ratio is staying the same. Photon density is staying the same. Baryon density is staying the same.
Mm-hmm.
So on that, where does the 3% of dark matter number come from? And I think maybe I missed that.
That comes from, the dark baryon, that if you take the sum of baryons and dark baryons, that has to go up like F squared. And then there's the ratio of baryonic matter to dark matter. And those two things together lead you to, oh, and then there's the 8% difference between, you know, 67 and 73.
Right, I see.
Those three things lead you to 2 to 3%.
That's interesting. Yeah, gives you a prediction. Yeah, and what's the minimal requirement on this dark baryon sector? Like, what can I say to say here's a way to test it? Because I guess you don't require any coupling to the standard model at all, right?
Right. We've required no coupling, so you know that'll just come out of attempts to actually build a that would come out of more specific model choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so then you're left to, without doing that, then you're left with, well, we're trying, one of the questions we have is, what are the constraints that we have now from data? Cause we just assumed that the binding energy of the dark sector divided by the temperature of the dark sector, binding energy of dark, hydrogen to the temperature of dark photons. We assume that we fixed that to be, so that recombination would happen in the dark sector, but when it happens in the light sector. Mm-hmm. But how much freedom is there in that? You know, so that's a question we haven't, we haven't worked out yet. And that would need to, in order to, start to make clearer predictions about what's needed in this dark sector.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thanks very much, Lloyd. That's really been great.
That was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
A great crowd.